Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here for Friday as we head into the long holiday weekend. Coming up on the program, there will be 7 new films about slavery coming out between now and the end of 2013. 7, all in 7 of them involve slavery in some way. Current state's Emmanuel Berry joins us later this hour. She talks with MSU filmmaker Jeff Ray about this interesting phenomenon. And we also talk mosquitoes later this hour. It's the worst year for mosquitoes in Michigan or mid-Michigan. I forget how they detail that, since 1994, so almost 20 years. At the top, mid-Michigan is still digesting the news that 7 men from the Lansing area have been convicted of federal drug crimes. 6 of the 7 have been sentenced to prison terms ranging from 1 to 4 years. This episode stems from a federal raid on several marijuana growing facilities in Okemos back in 2010. Defense attorneys, including our next guest, say that the group intended to run a completely legal marijuana growing business. Pot possession is still a federal crime, but enforcement and prosecution has been extremely confused in many states which have legalized the use of marijuana to varying degrees, and Michigan is certainly one of those states. East Lansing-based attorney Bob Baldori organized the legal team that represented the defendants. He joins us now. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
And on the phone, Okemos's Lance Forsberg, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison last month after his guilty plea. Hi, Lance.
Hello.
Bob Baldori, most, if not all, the defendants in this case pleaded guilty, yet you've called this a horrible miscarriage of justice. How so?
Well, they were forced into these pleas because of the draconian mandatory minimum sentence, federal sentencing guidelines. They were facing a downside of 20 years. And if they had gone to trial and lost, the judge would have had no leeway to do anything else but give them 20 years. So even if you have viable defenses that you think might work, you know, my rule of thumb in any litigation is the 80-20 rule. Even if you have the facts, the law, and the ability to litigate it, there's still a 20% chance you're going to lose, right?
Yeah.
And when you're going to lose, when you have a 20% chance of doing 20 years, it is an irrational choice to litigate it, even if you think you've got some winning arguments, if you can make a plea that'll get you out in 2 or 3.
Well, Lance Forsberg, talk to us about your participation in this enterprise.
In essence, basically, with the contracting background, I saw it fit to, after seeing the involvement with local enforcement saying it's okay and lawyers drawing up contracts, I basically would build grow facilities for caregivers. In essence, the environment has to be controlled, so I would bring in insulation, bring in air circulation, and make a sustainable environment for plants to be in outside of a residential home. Also with the fencing and the security measures, it was a safer, in my opinion, place to do this and allow a person to still go back to a residential home and exist as a resident.
Bob Baldori, my understanding has been that federal authorities have acknowledged that they're not too interested in prosecuting most, or at least many, marijuana crimes. Is that correct?
Well, Attorney General Holder issued a couple letters over the last couple of years that were supposed to be guidelines for regional federal prosecutors. And in the letters, he said that they, this is close to a quote, that they wouldn't prosecute Not that they wouldn't prosecute, but that it wasn't an efficient use of public resources to prosecute anyone in full and substantial compliance with state law. And it was because of phrases like that that defendants like these defendants moved forward, because they made extraordinary efforts to be in compliance with, in full and substantial compliance with state law.
Lance Forsberg, you pleaded guilty to what specific charges?
Basically, I pled guilty to three charges, operating a manufacturing facility of marijuana within 1,000 feet of a school, and conspiracy.
Where will you be serving your time?
I'll be down in West Virginia, basically is where I've been told to go. I got to report in and show up at a certain time and place.
How are you preparing for that?
You know, I've just been relying on my faith heavily. It's been a struggle, to say the least. And it's just been peeling layers back of sustainability, of anything that we take for granted in life. And so I've gotten to a point where through pressure and fire, I'm just trying to turn coal to a diamond here. And so just relying heavily on family and my faith and my belief in God.
Your father, Dennis Forsberg, is also set to serve a 3-year sentence. How is he handling this, and how is your family handling this?
You know, it's a struggle for all of us. The one thing I'm guaranteed is food and shelter for the next few years. My poor mother and a lot of our family members are the ones that are living in uncertainty at this point. Things, again, that we take for granted. Get taken away, and so that includes
how are they living in uncertainty, Lance?
Well, the level of uncertainty is just the simple fact that this is all such a gray area, and you know, my father being the patriarch and supporting my mother as she took care of 4 kids, they're taking away our patriarch and then a son as well, and so it's just very difficult. She's a baby boomer. She's not in a position to start a new career. And so that's where it really gets shaky as to what's going to happen to them in the next few years.
Bob Baldori, the way Michigan's medical marijuana law is supposed to work involves being either a patient certified by a physician and getting a card proving that, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think this is how it works, or being a caregiver. For a patient and getting a card so that you can grow pot. Were any of these 7 guys certified patients or caregivers?
They were all certified, well, depending on their specific job descriptions. I believe every one of them had a patient card, and several of them were caregivers. But they went, like I said, to extraordinary lengths to be in full and substantial compliance with Michigan law.
How much contact was there between the organizers of this business and police or the legal establishment before any growing began? Bob, is that clear?
Well, they made documented efforts to communicate with the police, the authorities in Meridian Township and in the next township.
North, Aladdin?
Aladdin Township. And I wasn't involved with them at that time, but I had many, many other clients that were interested in being patients and caregivers and understanding the law. In fact, I met with the prosecutor early after the passage of this law to try to get some definition for what was legal and what wasn't legal. And of course, they didn't have specific answers to a lot of the questions because the law was written in a confused way. But even knowing that, these defendants went out of their way to be within the parameters of Michigan law.
What about the number of plants that were confiscated?
They were well within the, each facility was designed to be a facility where a caregiver who's allowed to have 12 plants could raise marijuana for 5 patients, and he was allowed to have 12 plants for each patient. So that would be 72 that would be allowable in each facility under Michigan law. They were far below that number.
Chief Dave Hall of the Meridian Township Police Department told me yesterday that he vaguely recalled a visit he had with somebody in this group who asked about Michigan law. Did any of these local authorities testify in the case, Bob?
Well, it didn't get litigated, so there was no testimony.
Oh, okay. It was a guilty plea.
Right.
Okay. Lance, what is your understanding here with regard to the federal case against you? Lance, are you there?
I'm sorry. Go ahead again. I apologize.
Tell me about your understanding of this issue with regard to proximity to Okemos High School. That is a detail in the law, in the Michigan law, is it not?
Yeah, you know, back in 2010, that was something that was argued back and forth. There was some efforts to bring that into the law itself. However, it never really found any closure. And so going by the state law standards, it was something where, assumption being the key of all failure, we assumed that was okay, especially after talking with so many local officials. However, to find the printout or the manifesto of all the federal law, it really wasn't something, especially back then, that we even thought was transparent enough to find. And so it was an after-the-fact situation where we found out the hard way that this is what it is. And I'm not sure if they measure from property line to property line or building to building, but with a liquor store across the street and the buildings being tucked away far enough in the field, again, assumption being the key of all failure, we assumed that it was going to be okay.
Bob?
Well, you know, this is one of the points you could have litigated. Were they within 1,000 feet of Okemos High School? It depends on what, and we researched this issue heavily. It depends on, do you measure from door to door? Do you measure from property line to property line? And, of course, the intent of that law was to keep people from opening up head shops, you know, advertising, whatever, in proximity to a high school. It wasn't to prevent these inconspicuous warehouses that weren't even visible from the high school not to be used for what they were using it for. So that's, you want to take the risk of litigating that, which doubled all the, enhanced all the penalties, and maybe a win on it, maybe a don't. That was one of the many open questions in this case.
Lance, do you know who it was in your group that had contact with the authorities, with the police?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I came on as a contractor kind of after the fact. I've had a gambit of life skills, from gardening to chemistries to construction. And so I came on more just to help to manage and make sure that this was something that would be sustainable for the caregivers. So I saw the paperwork's drawn up, and everything seemed like the I's were dotted, the T's were crossed. However, as far as who actually approached everyone, I'm not entirely sure.
Bob, why do you feel that there ended up being a federal raid on these growing facilities? What was it about what these guys were doing that stood out to the feds?
Well, I think there were a couple of issues that offend authorities. One was... unfortunately, I think they were given bad legal advice at the time. They signed written agreements, lease agreements, that in the language in the agreements stated that they were setting up these facilities to manufacture marijuana. So it became a slam dunk once those agreements were revealed, and the defendants had signed them. On a real superficial level, that's an admission that you're conspiring to manufacture marijuana. So that gave the feds tons of leverage. The other thing is, and this is a quote from the judge, it's very offensive to me, but they claimed that the defendants were attempting to exploit the Michigan law for profit. My response to that, the average salary of an anesthesiologist is $280,000 a year. Drug companies mark up their their product 1,000%. They were offended that these people were possibly attempting to make money at this, even though they lost over six figures. I mean, nobody made money on this deal. And at the same time, simultaneously, I'm watching actually WKAR TV, and they're doing interviews with people from Washington and Colorado saying, we expect to make $1 billion this year off of medical marijuana, and you can trade it on the stock exchange. I mean, this is America. This is a capitalist society. To use that as an excuse to prosecute these guys is absurd.
Lance Forsberg, you want to follow up on that thought?
Well, yeah. You know, the thing that I like to really stress to people is this is a plant. It's not something that's concrete and guaranteed. And so anytime someone takes farming and then turns it into a sales venture, the potential for failure is almost imminent. It's something that... each crop is not guaranteed to have a certain amount or to even pay the bills. And so it's a very high-risk venture in all aspects of the word, from the legal issues to the actual potential for failure within the operation itself. And so farming meat sales is not something I recommend to anyone.
There's been so much overt confusion about the enforcement of marijuana laws. A lot of it, Bob Baldori, stemming from this disconnect between federal law and local or state laws. What needs to be done?
Well, it's wildly inconsistent because you can go across the country and find literally thousands of people doing openly and stating openly in California, in Washington, in Colorado, exactly what these guys were doing. And it's so inconsistent, and the feds aren't pursuing any of these people. They're on television saying they're doing it, and they're not being pursued. So this is so arbitrary. And part of the problem is that, the quote in the Holder memo is that Congress has declared that marijuana is a dangerous drug, which is like saying Congress has declared that the world is flat. It goes against all the science of the last 100 years. And what has to be done, one of the many things, is to take it out of the Schedule One. It's registered defined as a Schedule One substance. It shouldn't be. And the feds have been fighting that for 20 years. Once you take it out of Schedule One, which, makes it equivalent of cocaine and heroin,
right?
Then you can begin to deal with it rationally.
Lance Forsberg, we appreciate your time very much. We appreciate it an awful lot, and we wish you well. Bob Baldori, thank you as well.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Slavery is a part of American history, but it's a part people are not comfortable speaking about. So contemporary conversations about slavery often play out on the big screen, and apparently we still have a lot to say about it. Seven new films about slavery are slated to come out in 2013. Jeff Ray is a filmmaker and MSU professor who specializes in film studies and black U.S. cinema. He joined Current State's Emmanuel Berry to discuss slavery films coming out this year and films of the past. And listeners should know that this interview includes clips that may be offensive to some. Please take note. Emmanuel and Ray started out their conversation with Birth of a Nation.
That's kind of the start of American cinema history in a way. It is the first feature-length film, and it is the most successful early film. And it is one of the films that in the long history of American cinema that stands at the crux of kind of cinema, culture, and history. And at the same time that it was viewed as this breakthrough film by director D.W. Griffith, at the same time, it is still, I would say today, it is probably the most racist thing that I have ever seen. And so in teaching that film, it's an interesting thing because you teach it almost of two minds. Mm-hmm. It is both a very important film and a very cinematic film, and it is a brilliant film in a lot of ways. But it is also this racist film. So, you know, it's always a dilemma. I still have this dilemma of years of teaching. How do I approach this film?
Now, another earlier film, this is a little bit further down the road, about slavery, would be Gone with the Wind. And it's an interesting film, first of all, because African-Americans are kind of almost, it's a film about the Civil War, and African-Americans are kind of virtually absent from it, except for in the character played by Hattie McDaniels, and that won her an Oscar role. And I want to actually play a clip from her acceptance speech.
This is one of the happiest moments of my life. And I want to thank each one of you who had a part in selecting me for one of the awards. For your kindness, it has made me feel very, very humble. And I shall always hold it as a beacon for anything that I may be able to do in the future. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you. God bless you.
Now, it's a very heartfelt speech, but it is a speech that the studio wrote for her.
Yeah, the studio wrote for her. And again, you know, I think so often when we talk about race in an American context, and I think particularly in the very old construction of black-white context, there was often this divide. So at the same time that Hattie McDaniels is this very talented actress, and she gives a very moving, obviously a very moving speech, on accepting her Oscar, the first African-American to win an Oscar. There's a cringe in it because a lot of folks know that it was written by the studio, and then this credit to my race part.
Yeah, talk about those words. I hope I shall always be a credit to my race.
Well, you know, in talking about Gone with the Wind and talking about that performance, the question oftentimes comes up, as it does a lot of times with black actors working in Hollywood films, I think still to this day, I think the question becomes, are you truly a credit to your race? And what the hell does that mean? what does that mean anyway? You know, this was a controversial role that she played. She played a mammy figure, mammy character, which she played all of her screen career. She was very good at it. She was a very good actress. But at the same time, you know, it is a stereotype. And, mm-hmm. and what can you say? Oh, you play a stereotype, but you play it really well?
We have to talk about Roots.
Yes, we
even
do.
Though it's not necessarily a film, a cinematic film, but a TV special, but you can't not talk about Roots. So why, when you watch Roots, I guess, what kind of conversation is taking place in that film? Why is that film coming out at the time, and what are people trying to say with it?
Well, I think Roots is interesting for a whole lot of different reasons. One, because it captured such a large part of the American TV audience, and a lot of folks saw Roots. It's still one of the highest rated programs ever. And I think that Roots is presenting black folks, and I think very intentionally, presenting black folks and black history as an American story. And one of the things that Hollywood films do very well on one hand, and to their detriment on the other hand, but very well, I think, with Roots, is that in a lot of ways, it's less a film about black history and much more a film about this particular black family and their movement as a black family, as an American family. And you just had never seen that kind of story being told in American film, in American television, and with black folks as an American family, American family saga.
Now, in contrast to that, in the 70s, we have the film Mandingo, which is just, if you haven't, it's just a bizarre film. It's kind of about these cross-racial relationships between slave masters and slaves. It's very different than Roots, to say the least. And we have a clip from that film, and this is a slave who escaped. He's on the verge of escaping, and he's captured by another slave named Mandingo. And so a crowd has gathered to watch him get his punishment. But before we play it, I'd just like to note that this clip may be offensive to some and is not necessarily suitable for all ages.
Leastwise, I ain't gonna die like you gonna die, like a slave. I ain't giving no lifetime of misery and sweat to this pepper wood. I'd rather die than be a slave. You Peckerwood, that's right. You Peckerwood was oppressed in your own land. We was free. And you brought us here. In chains. But now we here. And you just better know. This is just as much our land as it is yourn. And after you hang me, kiss my ass.
Clearly a very different tone than Roots there. What does that film say, Mandingo, say about, how does that kind of reflect the time in a different manner?
Well, if Roots was trying to present this kind of high reading of Americanness, in a lot of ways, Mandingo presents a very true reading of Americanness. And so, and what I mean by that is that the film itself is a mismatch of a lot of different things mm-hmm. that are truly American. Miscegenation, race, radicalism, heroes and villains, white women placed on a pedestal, you know, good-looking, physical, black men as slaves, sexuality. So it takes all of that stuff, which, you know, I think it comes from a tradition of, there's a whole tradition of literature around those things, and it mixes it up into this potent kind of blaxploitation, kind of nationalistic, kind of sensational, kind of sexploitation film in Mandingo. And I have to say that Mandingo is one of my favorite films that I typically don't tell people that it's one of my favorite films.
A guilty pleasure film.
It is a truly guilty pleasure. And that scene that you played, I think, is evident of a kind of post-civil rights, post-black nationalist appeal there. And so you have this presentation of blackness that is tough, that is, and I think particularly tough in a male sense. You know, you Peckerwoods came here from your land. We were free, you know, and you're going to hang me, but you can kiss my you-know-what. And, you know, whenever I show that film in class, that particular scene raises these cheers, you know. And I always tell my students, you all, no matter what you are, black, white, or other, you are all like post-black nationalist folks. Mm-hmm. You understand.
You get it.
You get it.
Yeah.
And so I think that scene in particular is a scene that is evident of a 70s film that is informed by the times very much.
Now, as we kind of move on and we get into the 80s and 90s, the film Glory with Denzel Washington, another film where it's a little different because there's that anger there.
Right.
We all, that whipping scene that everyone right. always talks about. But it's another film that's kind of couched in this historical American sentiment. You know, there's that scene at the end where they're marching through the flags and mm-hmm. they're like, go get them and all of that. I guess talk a little bit about what that film says.
I think that I always theorize that black history is easier to tell on screen to a contemporary audience than contemporary black stories. I think that contemporary black stories are considered messy and people are kind of worried about offending and kind of don't know what angle to take and those kinds of things. But the history in a film like Glory, it's easy for a contemporary American audience to cheer for these black soldiers. It's easy for a contemporary American audience that is a mainstream audience, you know, and again, read broadly white, to say to themselves, oh, I'm on the right side of this. I'm on the right side of history. Oh, I'm for those black soldiers, former slaves, and everything. And so the historical story is a little bit easier sell, I think, to a broad American audience. But at the same time, the historical story, a film like Glory, also does, you know, kind of this Roots thing again. It brings blackness into the broader Americanness.
There's more than half a dozen slavery films coming out this year. Why? Why are there so many slavery films this year? And what are people trying to say with this? What does this say?
I think the main thing it says is that race, and again, particularly in the black, white kind of historical context, is a constant in American in American history and culture, politics, you know, social, everything. I think it's interesting that you start really the birth of American cinema with Birth of a Nation, and it has to do with,
all of these complex racial issues.
All these complex racial issues and the presentation of black stereotypes that become really entrenched in Hollywood cinema. Then you move to the film Gone with the Wind, which in some ways, I always tell my students this, that when people think about kind of Civil War and antebellum times, they rarely think of true history, but they think much more of the false history of Gone with the Wind. So that's a film that's so effective that that's become like the historical marker.
That is what history is.
And now we're again in our so-called post-racial times with our black president and all this stuff. We have, you know, a number of slave films that are coming out. And so I think it speaks to this kind of yearning in Americanness to still talk about this, to still try to understand it, to still either sensationalize it or get deeply into it.
Are there any of these films that you're looking forward to seeing or that you think are going to get it right? Has anyone gotten it right? Does that make sense?
I don't know if that's the right question to ask, but maybe it is the right question to ask. You know, maybe the right question to ask is, are you in the ballpark of getting it right?
Yeah.
If you get it right, that's maybe too much to ask.
Yeah, yeah.
But are you in the realm of right here? I think that may be the one to ask. I think the one I'm most interested in, Solomon Northrup, that is being directed by Steve McQueen, black British filmmaker. And I'm just interested in his perspective, and I also like him very much as a filmmaker. And so he's a really smart dude. And so I'm just interested to see what his kind of artistic taste is in all of this.
Are we ever done with the slavery film?
No. I think that in some ways the slavery film is related to the general American fascination with the Civil War. And so you have the Ken Burns piece, The Civil War, which, mm-hmm. you know, just did bang up business and just it is, you know, a wonderful piece. You have historical reenactments. You have people going to see battlegrounds. You have all that kind of stuff. You have kind of the lifting of the Civil War submarines that was, you know, a big cause last year. So I think there's a real fascination with Civil War. But at the same time, that fascination is limited when it comes to dealing with the main issue around the Civil War, you know. And I think that in a way, is kind of the American way. We're fascinated by the Civil War. We're fascinated by brother versus brother. We're fascinated by all those things. But when it comes to slavery, we want to take a step back. And when it comes to the aftermath of slavery, we want to take two steps back. And so I think that is both a fascination and a reluctance at the same time. You know, that kind of classic American dualism.
Jeff Ray is a filmmaker as well as MSU professor. He specializes in film studies and black U.S. cinema. Once again, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. If you've been outside in the last few weeks, and hopefully that means all of you, it's hard not to notice the swarms of attacking mosquitoes, the creepy buzzing in the ears, the itchy welts, the inordinate blood loss. They all seem particularly bad this spring, and here to tell us just how bad the mosquitoes are and why is Ned Walker. He's an MSU entomology professor and an expert on the dastardly mosquito. Welcome, Ned.
Welcome. Good morning.
It's not often I dust off dastardly, but I think in this case it is warranted.
It's warranted.
In 2013. Put this in some perspective for us. Why does 2013 seem so intense so far?
We have a very large population of one species of mosquito that we refer to as a floodplain mosquito.
Okay.
And people will recall that this spring, especially March and April, were heavy spring rains that caused floodplains to become inundated with water. And this particular species of mosquito lays its eggs in floodplain areas, and those eggs live for years without hatching. And in springs when we have heavy rainfall, the floodplains will become full of water and rise up to the egg horizon where those eggs happen to be distributed. They'll hatch. The larval stages of the mosquitoes grow in the floodplain waters, and then they hatch out as adult mosquitoes. The last time we saw this happen, and the kind of numbers we're seeing now, was 1994. So it's cyclical, and you can even have a decade or more of time between these events. And this happens to be a year when that kind of weather, combined with the biology of this particular floodplain mosquito, together have created these hordes of biting mosquitoes right now.
We seem to be going through regular periods of very dry weather, though, as well. And it doesn't seem to have any impact on the mosquito population. Doesn't drought or semi-drought conditions have any impact on the mosquito population?
Well, I think actually it does. We should ordinarily, and I'm starting to think there is no such thing as an average year based on the kind of patterns we have like this year. But last year, people will recall that March was a very warm and dry year in 2012. And that actually eliminated a crop of spring mosquitoes that we would ordinarily have seen last year. And that's even rebounded into this year. Probably there are a group of mosquitoes we call our spring mosquitoes. They're one generation a year. They're associated with melting snow and spring rains that form woodland pools that are temporary. And those mosquitoes did not materialize too much last year because of that really unusually warm March. And then this year, they're also missing. We're not really seeing those at all.
So those are a different species from the floodplain mosquitoes?
They are. They have a similar kind of lifestyle in that they appear in the spring as our first large brood of biting mosquitoes. But the floodplain mosquitoes are the ones that are specifically associated with river and stream floodplains, and their eggs are there. The others are in woodland pools not associated with rivers and streams.
Well, in a suburban setting, though, would that be the floodplain mosquito, most likely?
Right.
Okay. How many different types of mosquitoes are there in Michigan?
There are 60 different species of mosquitoes in Michigan, and I tend to group them into categories based on their life histories, and that can boil down to five major groups. And one of them is the spring cohort of mosquitoes that I've been describing that are all associated with, as the snow melts and forms pools of water in low-lying woodland areas. And then they have typically one generation a year. And then we have summer floodwater mosquitoes. And those start to appear as our summer cycle of rain and drying out appears. And their eggs are in low-lying grassy areas like meadows, wet meadows, roadside ditches, and you can have many generations of those through the summer. And those are the two major groups of nuisance mosquitoes.
How many of these 60 species, though, how many of these bite?
About. Yeah, all but one. We have one species that doesn't bite at all. And interestingly, another one bites only bullfrogs. So there's a lot of variation. We have some that only bite birds, and then we have quite a few that will bite mammals and, of course, including humans, and those are our pest mosquitoes.
Which ones are responsible for the West Nile virus?
Interesting question. The ones that are out right now are not responsible for that at all. That virus is carried by a mosquito that's associated with our wastewater and storm rainwater retention and catchment systems. Also, it's found in places like abandoned swimming pools, which is a big issue lately because of the economic conditions. So it's a mosquito that, as a larva, lives in really man-made water conditions, and that peaks in abundance in populations in July, August, and September. So our West Nile risk goes up really much later in the summer, and it's low now.
Mm. Does mosquito abatement on a town or a city level work generally?
Actually, it works very well. We have four county level mosquito programs in Michigan in the Saginaw Bay area, and then there are quite a few township level programs, and they're funded by local millages. And they suppress the mosquito populations through really integrated approaches. It would be incorrect to assume they're just spray programs because they involve trapping and monitoring and all kinds of sophisticated approaches.
Here in the Lansing area?
Lansing area, we don't have programs, although people can certainly, just to give you an example, and a lot of phone calls come in this time of year across my desk and others, but people ask this if they're going to have a graduation party in their backyard and the mosquitoes are just too thick to have a good time. You can contract with a pest control operator or a company. They can come in and give a treatment that'll last, you know, a day or two.
There's a lot of commercial businesses that have grown up that spray.
There are, yes.
What are some of the best ways that we can protect ourselves against mosquitoes and get rid of them?
Well, community-wide programs really are effective, but organizing those and moving through the combination of funding and politics is an interesting process that a lot of communities aren't able to do. Separate from that, the homeowner can take individual actions or neighborhoods. And then, of course, there's personal protection, which involves use of repellents. Also, mosquitoes are invasive into homes. For example, the mosquito that's out, this floodplain mosquito, will readily come indoors to bite. And if you leave your back door propped open to let your dog run in and out
that
or whatever.
That is the worst.
Yeah.
That is the worst in our house, is those moments after it's dark when you let the dog out or you got to go out in the garage. That is just almost suicidal.
Yeah, even that, and you're just that temporary moment when you've got the door propped open a bit and you're calling your dog to come in or, you know, or whatever, you're barbecuing and the mosquitoes come in very quickly and then you've got them indoors.
Yeah.
So you want to try to, you know, keep your screens repaired and all of that and try to keep barriers up so that mosquitoes can't come in and get you.
You shared the neatest story of how you got into this. Tell our listeners that.
Well, we bug people, you know, have interesting histories, I guess. I collected an Io moth under a streetlight in my hometown in Ohio when I was 12, and that got me hooked. Later, when I was in college, I knocked on a professor's door and I just sort of peeked in there and said, you know, I'm interested in insects. And within 10 minutes, he was offering me a job in his lab. And that, you know, that little gesture of kindness.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
Knocked on a guy's door and 10 minutes later had a job.
Yeah, that was it.
I have to say, I was telling our guest here that one of my fondest academic memories was the insect collection that we were required to have as a 10th grader in my biology class. That has stayed with me for so many years. It was just the neatest experience. It was an opportunity to get outside, but it was an opportunity to really explore the diversity in the insect world. It's really mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are more kinds of insects, different species, than any other organism. And it might sound like a highly specialized discipline, but actually it's not from that point of view. And, of course, the aesthetics of insects, very appealing. We like to try to emphasize the positive side of insects. We've been talking about mosquitoes, which people typically would have a negative view. But, of course, insects do our pollination for us. They make honey for us. They do all kinds of important things. There are a lot of insects that are damaging, but many of them are either just beautiful to look at or are important in certain ways.
There's also a very curious insects as food movement that has sprung up. Tell us about that.
There is, and of course the gut reaction is what? But many cultures actually eat insects, and if you travel in the tropics and you go to local markets and you'll see insects available for sale for food. And I travel to Africa routinely, and people commonly eat termites, for example, and they're not harmful to eat, and they're a great source of protein. The idea that we could supplement our own diets through use of insects as a protein dietary supplement is an interesting one, and there's also a sort of a fad associated with insects and food, and they're edible.
It is a big cicada year out east, but that apparently is not going to be a problem here in the Midwest?
No, we're not going to see a huge cicada population this year. This is, the cycles vary from region to region, and you're right. And I think it's the sort of the mid-Atlantic states, isn't it, where they're going to see the large
outbreak.
That's
what I've heard.
Yeah, and that'll come about, and it has to do with the very long life cycles of these periodic cicadas, which is fascinating, 14-year cycles and 17-year cycles. Mm-hmm. We have them here as well, but this year is not going to be one of our peak years.
Ned Walker is an MSU professor of entomology and a mosquito expert. Ned, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
In March, Spartan Hospitality Group here at Michigan State University launched a new venture it hoped would change the nature of fast food on the MSU campus and beyond. It's called the Food for Thought Food Truck. Since then, business has steadily grown. The culinary crew has taken its wares to such venues as the Taste of East Lansing Festival, and they've been able to use more local ingredients grown on the MSU campus that weren't in season when they first started. Current state contributor Judy Smelser gives us a closer look at food on the go, Spartan style.
Say fast food, and most people picture themselves in the car rolling up through the drive-thru. But what if you could turn that notion around? What if the food had its own wheels and came to you instead? And what if that food was gourmet? That concept has become reality right here in East Lansing with the Food for Thought food truck.
What can I do for you today?
Joel Heberlein, executive director of Spartan Hospitality Group, says that access to food on such a large campus can be a challenge.
Most of campus shuts down between 12 and 1 o'clock. We thought by providing mobile food that we could fill a need, fill a void that we had.
Do you want anything else? Maybe some chips or something to drink?
Food trains tend to get here a little slower than, you know, the big cities, obviously, California, New York, Boston.
Michael Klein is the senior executive chef of Spartan Hospitality Group.
Whatever they're doing that's big there, we take a look, and if we think it's something that would fit here at MSU, we like to bring it here and let the local folks have a go at it.
This latest trend in mobile dining hit the streets of East Lansing last month. Chef Matt Wilson is in charge of the day-to-day operations. He says that after spending 4 years as the chef of the stateroom, running a food truck is a new experience.
This is the first one. I've always been a restaurant hotel chef. That's where I came from. I've been doing that for nearly 20 years now.
When I caught up with the Food for Thought team, they were at the Kellogg Center main kitchen prepping for the day's run.
The pre-flight every day is a whirlwind. I come in at 7 a.m. and then we start doing all the day's production, the fresh cut produce, vegetables, all that stuff.
The food is more upscale than your regular food truck, and our menu changes every week, so we're trying to be a little higher quality.
The main focus is on bold flavors, freshness of products. Really, if you have those two things and a skilled people putting it together, you really can't go wrong.
What makes this food truck special is the fact that most of the food served is locally sourced.
We have the Bailey Hoop House, which supplies us with herbs and lettuces. A lot of our breads we order from the MSU bakery. They make our cookies for us. All the pork that we've served so far out of this is raised for us as well by the student organic farm.
I gotta pull the rice out of the steamer right quick.
Cook Ron Canella showed me the wide range of menu items available that week.
This is an Indian vegetarian Indian dish with curry, chickpeas in there, kidney beans, sweet potatoes, turnips. I make a lamb jus that goes with our gyros.
Hey, what do you guys want to grab some water or a rag and rinse this coffee thing out really quick?
As preparations continued through the morning, Chef Matt wore a variety of different hats, including mechanic, handyman, and truck driver.
Fixes everything with a coat hanging. He's like MacGyver.
Like everyone else on the MSU campus, one of the biggest challenges for the Food for Thought team is parking. The main library is the destination for this day's run.
We like to try and get over by the bridge. There's a lot of good foot traffic. Unfortunately, we can't reserve a parking spot or anything like that.
With the parking spot secured and the truck opened up, the Food for Thought crew is ready for business. And a high-speed business it is, as cook Ron Canellis explained.
Our ticket times are 3 minutes, where if you're standing in a line in a restaurant, it's usually anywhere between 12 to 15 minutes.
As the lunch hour approaches, so do the customers.
The pork meatloaf sandwich. It's wrapped in bacon. You really cannot go wrong with that.
Okay, I'll try that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm really impressed. I thought it was only going to be hot dogs and, you know, gross hamburgers, and it's not.
It tastes amazing.
The food here looks more interesting. Today they have gyros and Indian food.
It was better than I could have hoped.
Currently, the truck is available for catering events ranging from private parties to local festivals. By fall, students will be able to use their combo exchange for purchases. Joel Heberlein elaborated on his future goals for the project.
Ultimately for us is that we have long lines of people wanting to enjoy the food, or that we have so much demand that we have to actually add more trucks to the fleet.
As Chef Matt sees it, prospects for the future of the Food for Thought truck are bright.
I guess people should know that we're looking to make a positive impact for not only campus, but the community in general.
Chef Mike Klein echoed that sense of confidence.
Just come out to the truck and try it. Once you've tried it, you'll be back.
You can check Facebook and Twitter for more information about what's on this week's menu and where to find the Food for Thought truck.
See you next week.
Yes, all right. Ma'am, we'll be here.
For Current State, this is Judy Smelser.
And our producer, Chicago native Joe Lindstroth, admits the Blackhawks looked last night like they were skating in cement. Red Wings, Chicago, Game 5 tomorrow in Chicago. What a great way to celebrate May. Fantastic. And Detroit with a 2-0 win last night. Jimmy Howard, 27 saves. Miguel Cabrera, I understand, has hit safely in 9 straight games. Tigers coming from behind to beat Minnesota yesterday. Kind of a bit of a sports break there going into the long weekend. Maybe you'll have time to indulge in some sports this weekend. Coming up this weekend on Current State, does practice make perfect? According to a new study, maybe not. Emmanuel Berry discusses what it takes to truly master something tomorrow on Current State Weekend. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at lansingchamber.org. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at lsj.com.